So I mentioned earlier today, it is Tisha B'Av. It is the ninth of the month of Av, and therefore considered one of the saddest days in Jewish history. And we, of course, will mark that after Shabbat, which is never a day of sadness. At 8 o'clock, 8:30, I guess, for Sudat Slishit, and 8:45, and then after Sudat Slishit and Havdalah, we'll move into the observances for Tisha B'Av. But since today is indeed the ninth of Av, I want to look at a couple of examples of what we call Sinat Chinam, or senseless hatred that occurred in Israel while I was there or immediately right after. I then want to examine and I want to explode the myth of Sinat Chinam the way we tell it by looking at a text which really problematizes our normal understanding of senseless hatred. And then, taking a clue from Isaiah, I want to end on hopefully a little bit of a note of uplift as well. For those of you who are following some of my Facebook posts, you notice I mentioned at least in one of them about Women of the Wall, or in one of my writings, I'm a little confused. But the month of Menachem Av, of welcoming Av in, is when the Women of the Wall traditionally go to pray at the Kotel. And once again, there was violence in their desire to pray in their own way at a holy site for the Jewish people. I myself did not go because I think I'm still traumatized from the times I have gone to Women of the Wall in the past. It is a bit of a zoo, but some of my colleagues went for their first time, and like me, I don't think they'll be going back because they were cursed and spit at, even though in parts of the ultra-Orthodox community, there's a tradition that you don't touch a woman because of the rules of shomer negia, of certain types of modesty. That didn't stop some of these Haredi boys from pushing and pummeling and headbutting some of the women who were trying to pray in their own fashion. So that occurred. Simultaneously, one of my colleagues, Rahun, was arrested for performing a marriage in Israel. And of course, non-Orthodox rabbis are not permitted to perform marriages. And when the conservative rabbis, my colleagues in Israel, do so, they always make sure that the couple has gotten married, normally outside of Israel, with secular papers first, so that it's only a private sort of ceremony. In this case, the couple was not permitted to marry because the rabbanut had accused one of them of being a mamzer, someone eligible to marry. Our colleague had researched, found out that was not the case, and eventually the rabbanut, the Israeli rabbinical authorities, realized that the person was not. But in the meantime, he performed this wedding and was arrested for doing that. Now, if you're into law, it's actually, there's a little bit of an irony here, because according to the rabbanut, a conservative rabbi not only can't perform a wedding, but there's no wedding that occurs when the rabbi does so. So in a certain sense, the person was arrested for a non-legal act, for doing nothing, in other words. And indeed, the person was released later that same day and ended up speaking in front of the Knesset in a pre-arranged description, really talking about some of the ways we might work to build a fairer society. So on the surface, those both look like, and in some ways are examples of sinat chinam, of senseless hatred, of hatred that lacks a basis. And a text that probably anyone who's hung out in Jewish circles long enough would be familiar with states that what is senseless hatred, or what is not an argument for the sake of heaven? The case of Korach and his band, when 200 people make a play for power against Moses, that's called an argument that's not for the sake of heaven. But the arguments between Beit Hillel, the Academy of Hillel, and Beit Shammai are considered an argument for the sake of heaven. And therefore, it's okay to argue so long as there seems to be a higher purpose to it. We familiar with that? If you've heard that discussion, just go ahead, raise your hand. Let's get a sense. So a fair number of us are familiar with that. The problem with that is that when we dig deep into the text, we need to understand, well, actually, how did Hillel and Shammai disagree with one another? And was it really for the sake of heaven? And if it is for the sake of heaven, we have to understand what that means in a very different way. There is a well-known, but maybe a little bit more obscure text that comes out of the Yerushalmi, out of the Jerusalem Bible, and in it in Shabbat 1:4 there, we hear about a case in which Hillel and Shammai's arguments didn't exactly match the image that we would imagine from what the other version I just said. And the Mishnah reads, these are the laws they said in the attic of Hanya ben Chizkiah ben Gurion when they went to visit him. They voted, and Beit Shammai was the majority over Beit Hillel, and they decreed 18 things that day. So to unpack it, this is a story of Beit Shammai, normally in the minority, normally losing out in arguments with Beit Hillel. But on this particular day, in a vote that took place at somebody's nice loft apartment, Beit Shammai actually won on 18 matters. That's the Mishnah. Now here comes the Gemara there. It said, that day was as bad for Israel as the day the golden calf was made. Seems like a nice legal election. How come it would be as bad as when our people committed the ultimate act of apostasy, of idolatry, and separated themselves out from the entire mission of the people? What on earth could be that bad? Rabbi Joshua Onaya taught, the students of Beit Shammai stood at the bottom of the stairs, and they killed the students of Beit Hillel. It was taught, six of them went up to the attic, and the rest of them attacked with spears and swords. It was taught, for 18 things they decreed, and in 18 they were the majority. So these people whose arguments we are supposed to model our behavior on, whose arguments are for the sake of heaven and therefore not an example of senseless hatred, killed on that day in order to get their version of reality into the marketplace. This was not a free exchange of ideas that way. Now, often when we study Talmud, we have to decide what is real and what's not, what is just an apocryphal story. It should be noted that of these things that were decided, there is a decree that a large number of them are going to last for all time. In other words, when Hillel re-exerted its authority on the legal system as the party of majority power, those decisions could not be overturned, even though the way in which they were enacted had tremendous violence in it. And Shaul Lieberman, the great rabbi, you didn't study with him, did you, Rabbi Isaac?
Nope.
Yeah, okay, that's why you're still intact. He was pretty, talk about a forceful argumentations. He is, because these laws were kept on the books, he's convinced, and others are as well, that this is not just a story, but an actual event grounded in reality. So the very people who are an example of not engaging in senseless hatred are actually responsible for the commission of murder in order to achieve their place in the market. And Korach and his sons are not considered for the sake of heaven. So if we take that seriously, those texts, and want to resolve them somehow into a lesson we can understand, what can we get out of that? I don't know what we can get out of that is the true answer, but I want to propose the following. Korach and his people clearly were operating just out of a sense of personal power. They didn't have an overriding narrative that they really believed in. Their notion, everyone's holy like you, was sort of thrown on, and the weight of rabbinic history is that it really was just a pure power grab. But when it came to Hillel and Shammai, each of them had a very clear understanding, a narrative, a legal philosophy of what society should look like, and they were unwilling to yield on their narratives. They held tightly to their identity and who they were. And I think that that's an important distinction, because while I believe in dialogue, and you have heard me talk about it so much, at the same time, if we are not committed to our ideals and our values, then we've lost something very essential. And that creates a problem, because it means that in a case at Women of the Wall, for example, when our people are being attacked, they're being attacked because there is a genuine narrative on the other side, a narrative that we do not accept, that we do not believe in, an understanding of what Judaism is about that is going to be forcefully defended. And somehow we have to understand that that also is for the sake of heaven. But we have to do it in a way where we hold on to our narrative at the same time and have a faith and a hope that over the course of history, things do change. And things do change. And they normally change for the better in ways that are hard for us, caught in the moment, to see. In fact, later that day, someone, when she learned who we were, said to us, "I'm so sorry that happened, and I want you to know that's not Israel. That's not what I believe. That's not what my friends believe." And that if we stay true to our ideals, history in the long run and the bending of that arc will bring them closer to fruition. But here's another piece about how crazy it is when we think about this context and of Israel and how we think of it. We met with a reporter who shared some very interesting things about how Israel gets reported in the news. And one of the things you need to understand is that in Israel, in the AP, there are more reporters for the AP in Jerusalem than in all of China and 50 African nations. There are more reporters looking at every incident and reporting it, so that our availability heuristic, the things we think about when we think about Israel, are negative. And that, in a certain sense, is sinat chinam. It's senseless hatred because it perverts our perspective on what happens. So let me share with you a couple of figures that I found rather remarkable. If I can, yes. There are 860,000 residents in Jerusalem. And in 2017, and last year, there were 27 violent incidents. 27, and that includes murder. Not good. But to put it in perspective, a city of a similar size here in America, a city that nobody thinks of as filled with senseless hatred, is called Indianapolis. Same population. And in 2017 in Indianapolis, there were 175 violent incidents. And in Jacksonville, there were 135 violent incidents. And in all of Israel in 2017, 76 people were killed. So when we think about it, we really need to be careful about what it is we're thinking about. There are ways in which Jerusalem is 5 times safer than Indianapolis. 5 times safer. How many people, when you go to Indianapolis, say, travel safely? I mean, maybe if you're going to a Colts game, maybe you need that prayer, but... So things, in many ways, are better than what we imagine. And narratives matter so much. I was sitting closer than I am to you right now, Karen, with Saeb Erekat, who is the chief Palestinian negotiator. Very slick individual. And one of the lines that he shared with me was when we talk about, will the Palestinians recognize Israel and the Israeli story? And he said, that's not for me. I'm not going to accept the Israeli narrative. I have my narrative. The Israelis can believe their narrative, but you can't ask me to buy in or believe in someone else's narrative. It's a difficult concept, and I don't think that rules out the possibility of peace. But it highlights for us that at essence, when we look at the Middle East, we're talking about not a political struggle, and in some ways not even a religious struggle, but a desperate existential fight about identity. And that to yield to anyone, and by the way, in Hebrew and Arabic, you'll never find a word for a win-win situation. It doesn't exist. And in fact, one Israeli person once said, when I first thought I would win-win, it's great. I win twice. I win and then I win again. That when we are at heart in an argument about who we are, and anything that I yield to you in that takes away a part of who I am as a person. And that makes the peacemaking endeavor very, very difficult. And yet, I fully believe that while we can't impose our narratives, our stories, our values on anyone else, we can meet with them, we can talk with them, and we can listen. And that out of listening and compassion and concern and understanding and respect for somebody else's story, they will be heard, and that can create an opening. The mere fact that I hear your story can begin to change my story and vice versa. The story of Sinat Chinam is not a simple one. It is filled with murder, violence against democratic institutions of free votes, and yet we are told elsewhere that Hillel and Shammai, despite all of that, despite their difference of narratives, still found a way to have Shabbos together, to marry one another. We're neighbors. The Israelis and the Palestinians are neighbors. We're neighbors with each other and with the larger world. Let's hold on to our values, our commitments, the things that make us who we are, that we deeply care about. Let's struggle for them, but in that process, let us be caring enough to hear and recognize and even understand the validity of a viewpoint that challenges our most basic tenets, and hear it. And let it sit with us, and hope that someday a peace will happen in which each of us will be safer than we ever would be in Indianapolis. Shabbat shalom.